Hello, and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. About 10 years ago, when this program was just getting started, I read The Fabulous Sylvester, the definitive biography of the late great disco diva Sylvester, a San Francisco gay icon. The author, Josh Gamson, came on the show and shared the stories. Now he's back on the air with me with new stories. Stories of how several LGBT people, including himself, and actually some not LGBT people, including himself and his husband Richard, made families, had children. He's a professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. Joshua Gamson, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
It's great to be back.
This book
took
is
me 10 years, but I'm here.
This book is quite a departure from your other ones. What was it like to share such a personal story of how you came to be a parent? That's not something you'd done before.
No, it isn't, and it is hard. It took a lot of. It's one of the reasons it took a lot of time to do it. But I really wanted to have something for my kids. That was the sort of initial impetus, was that I was writing it up.
The story of how it became,
yeah,
you became our kids.
Yeah, I was just writing it up for my kids because I knew I'd start forgetting right away. And once I'd done that and started talking about it with people, they were really interested. You know, when you're so close to it, it feels like just your story, but it was clear that it was an unusual story.
And there were other stories. There were five or six stories, I think. And there are different people from different walks of life that you've known who are LGBT and not, and also heterosexual and single and married and not, you know, all kinds of different people, but trying to conceive a child without the natural, not natural. That's, see, there's the prejudice. The natural way. There it is. There,
yeah.
I just stumbled into it. How's that?
That's okay. Some of it's natural. Some of it's social. Some, you know, it's all
but
mixed
it's scientific.
Up, which is the point.
If you if you're two gay men and you want to have a baby, you've got to really want to have a baby.
That's for sure. It's
and
a lot
I'm
of
sure everybody's
engineering.
Asking you stupid questions because we're all sort of ignorant about that, probably.
No, and that was one of the other things that triggered the book. I mean, from just telling my own story to the book about all these other stories, was that we would walk down the street. I would walk down the street when Reba was a baby. That's our first child. And people would say, "Where did you get her?"
And where did you get her? I went to Walmart. Well,
that's what was kind of when I was.
You were ready
I came
to
up with all these snarky responses, but eventually I became a little bit more generous about what that questioning was about, and it just seemed
because it was
to be
curiosity
about, yes.
More than it was prejudice.
Yeah,
it's
well,
ignorance.
You know, sometimes it was ignorance and prejudice, but some, you know, a lot of the time it was. I don't know how these changes are happening. I don't know how people are.
How did two men
becoming
have a baby?
Families? Yeah. So,
except if they impregnated a woman and then she died and then they took custody. I mean, they could do that, but it always had to be about, you know, this heterosexual paradigm.
Often they assumed that we adopted, so that was their sort of go-to.
Well, especially if the child was, like I know a lot of back in beginning in the 90s, a lot of lesbians in Berkeley went to China and adopted Chinese babies.
Right.
That
was
because they were the only, and lesbians were the only ones who would take babies of color.
Right.
For a long time.
Right. And that was true in the first wave of gay men having kids outside of heterosexual marriages anyway.
Yeah, they'd give you the children of color or from poverty or poor nations, or you would take, because you would take, the gay people would take the disadvantaged people more than the heterosexual Caucasian people who wanted Caucasian babies from Finland or some crap.
Right. And that's not the case in, you know, in every one of these families. So,
no, it's
all changing.
It's a mishbucha. I mean, you got a lot of stuff going on with all these people. I mean, there's some extremely complicated stories here of just ridiculous proportions.
Yeah,
and
you
so
gotta really want it.
You gotta really want it. And so, I guess that leads me. Well, were there moments where you doubted it? Or some of the people that you talk about, the other stories, were there moments where they just wanted to give up?
You know, I think a lot of new parents will tell you that the moment when they want to give up and doubted it is after the kid is in their family and they have a.
Because there's
like, Oops, we got to raise this kid now, you know.
Because there's so many new issues then. It's not about getting the child. It's about raising the child and the child who is other and their other, your other. The child always feels other. How do you handle the otherness for not yourselves? Because I think as adult gay men, you're used to being other and your partner is half African-American.
Right.
And so he's used to being other and being gay is other. And yet you're raising these children, you want the best for them, and you have to tell them, yeah, don't feel other, but they're going to feel other.
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, you know, we're the only gay dad family in our school that I know of right now, in the kids' school.
And this is in San Francisco.
This is in Oakland. And that's,
oh,
that's
in Oakland.
That's, yeah. That's, you know, it's not that hard. It's just, you know, we stick out a little bit. And the kids, when they meet us, have to process it a little bit. But it passes really, really quickly, at least around here. So I don't feel like that's the biggest challenge right here where I am. It's one of the reasons I live where I live, so that kind of difference pretty quickly for a lot of people becomes uninteresting and unremarkable, and they're relating to us as parents, and, you know, we're all sort of assessing each other's parenting and not so
looking
much,
at gender,
you know,
and sexual preference and right. all, or sexual, you know, orientation.
Or sometimes we're a nice novelty, you know.
Oh, there's the gay dad, so
yeah,
I feel
right.
better about myself because
right.
I saw that show, Modern Family.
Right.
I mean, and the book is called Modern Family, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship, Modern Families. And, of course, the sitcom came out in 2009, Modern Family, and it hit the zeitgeist.
It did.
Of what we were all going through, the changing American family. And I think that that's helped pave the way for, I mean, it didn't pave the way. It hit the zeitgeist. It hit, this was what was happening in America. And it became a hit because it was funny and had great acting. But it also became a hit because it touched a nerve of it. People could relate to it because there's more different kinds of family than the old Housie and Harriet thing, which is not even true. I mean, you write this thing in the introduction, your friend Stephanie Kuntz, you say, saying much family discourse is based on nostalgia for the way we never were.
Mm-hmm.
What
yeah.
does that mean? Tell us about that.
That there's a myth that the mom, dad, woman at home taking care of the kids, man at work, so on, that family has always existed as the ideal family and as the normal family. And that's,
it
you
wasn't,
know, historically,
it isn't...
that's just not the case. And so there's lots of historical writing now about
it was kind of a new
what
idea.
Actually was there. It's more that there's this ideology that there's one true family, one way of being that is now being dismantled, and our families are sort of walking, I don't know, wrenches in the system. When people see us, it doesn't hold. They see that we are an intact family, that we are a loving family. They see, you know, my friend, she's called Rachel in the book, who's raising a kid that she adopted from Ethiopia by herself. They see these families, and the idea that there's just one true normal way to be a family is hard to hold on to.
Well, I think that started when that sitcom came out and was a hit. You've got the two gay men raising a girl from one of the Asian countries. You know, they adopted her, you know,
right.
And you've got, and there's just so many different ways now, as you write in the book, to adopt or to conceive or to plant embryos and get people to carry the baby to term after somebody, you, I know Richard, your husband, he contributed the sperm for Reba.
Oh, actually, we don't say.
Oh, you don't say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Not sure,
well,
where
somebody,
you're getting that.
I don't know, making
it
up,
put
huh?
it in the book.
You didn't? All right, never mind. I've stepped over
That's
my boundaries.
That's quite all right. I have clear boundaries.
But I'm glad. I have such curiosity about it, I suppose, and I'm so fascinated by your. It takes courage. I think that's what I really want to talk about, is it takes a lot of courage to do what you've done, not just to write the book, but for each one of these stories in the book, it took a lot of courage to make a child, to create what you call kinship. In the title, The Journeys to Kinship. And I really love your use of that word.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just family. It's a sense of kinship. Can you talk about what led you to that word?
Yeah, I mean, I guess partly just the word family is overused. And, you know, I didn't want that actual word itself. But I like the expansiveness of the word kinship. It covers so much. It covers people who are related biologically, people who are related legally, people who are related
by choice.
So I wanted an expansive term.
Mm-hmm. And more than saying the word family, which is a little bit,
I don't know, it calls to mind
loaded.
That one
it's
true,
loaded.
You know,
that's right.
this image of a family. And I wanted to say about the courage point, I appreciate that, but it didn't feel like that to me.
I don't think courage ever does.
Determination,
I think people do.
You know, I was certain I was going to do it, and we were just going to do it. We weren't asking; we were doing, and that was true in our case, and I think in all of these stories. Additionally, we had resources, and most of these families required some amount of resources to make. So, you know, there's a combination, a complicated combination of courage, determination, privilege and resources,
right,
and
money,
happenstance. Mm-hmm.
But you never gave up. And then you had Reba, and then let's read a little bit from the book. You're listening to Out of the Bay. My guest is Josh Gampson. He's written the book Modern Family: Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Let's hear a little bit about Reba, your firstborn.
Okay, I'm just going to read you about the beginning of Reba.
Okay.
Just after New Year's in 2004, I had a dream that my college girlfriend Tamar was having a baby. It was a dream without much originality, just a string of clips from those birth scenes you see on TV medical shows. Woman being wheeled, screaming down the green halls of a hospital. Calm, concerned face of doctor saying things like, just breathe and blah, blah, stat. Hospital room, sounds of baby cries, close-up of euphoric face of a woman, now mother, cooing and gazing into the face of a swaddled infant, now gurgling. The only difference was that the woman was Tamar, her freckled cheeks ruddy, her red hair matted with sweat. A bloodless, simple birth in which bliss erases pain. It was as if even my dreams were required to acknowledge how far the reality of childbirth was from my reach. After all, it takes an awful lot of work to have a baby when, if you're a male couple like me and Richard, you're missing two of the three crucial elements. An extra penis is nice, but not exactly needed.
And that reminds me of how funny the book is as well. And there's just some hilarious things that happen in all the different stories. There's moments of wonderment and joy and hilarity, and you write it in such a way, you're channeling a little bit of Sylvester after writing the fabulous Sylvester book 10 years ago. It really affected you. I remember interviewing you here on this program about that book, and it shifted you. It gave you something that you've kept with you that I read in these pages here. I see.
Thank you. I hope that's true.
It is. It's got this, you know, queer sensibility. It's not, you know, assimilated gay stuff. It's got a queerness to it and a wildness to it in the way you've written it.
Yeah, I think what happened is it's got a meanness. Like, I became more me, you know, through Sylvester. That's kind of his effect on
That's
people,
right.
I think.
And so you were going to read us another piece, but this isn't. So you go through all of these things. I'd like people to read the book and buy the book because it's deep. The complicated stories are truly great reading because they're deeply convoluted. The way these things happened, there were obstacles. There were things in the way. It was just difficult in each situation, it seems like.
Right. Different difficulties in each situation.
Yeah.
But in our case, getting from that dream to a baby involved, you know, finding and getting Tamar eventually agreed to carry a baby. She didn't want to use her own eggs. And so we needed to find an egg donor. Then we needed to decide who was going to donate the sperm.
Right.
Then we needed to figure out how to get the money to pay for all the medical stuff. Then we needed to figure out the legal maneuvering to get to make sure we were protected and figure out the laws about surrogacy in different places and, you know, arrange all the travel and arrange all the... It's so elaborate.
How did you maintain
a job? It was really wild. I'm not exactly sure how I
maintained a job. Josh Gampson is professor of sociology at University of San Francisco here in San Francisco. So I don't know how you did all that, but
I'm not sure.
It was a full-time gig.
Yeah, I'm not. It was.
Let's read a little bit more about Reba.
So this is just a little piece from right after Reba was born, after all of that elaborate stuff had happened. And she was born on Martha's Vineyard, where my parents lived and where we were also married. "Hi, Reba Sadie," I said. I didn't wipe my tears away. There are times when it's only right to overflow. I thought, this is the first time I'm seeing your face, Reba Sadie. I thought, you found us. Richard held her up toward the fluorescent-lit ceiling, Kunta Kinte style, crying and chuckling. We took her out to the hallway to meet her grandparents. My mother turned to Richard's mother. "Look at those lips," she whispered. Later, a nurse asked us whether we wanted to keep the placenta. "Sure," Richard said. When Reba, Sadie, and Tamar were released a few days later, the placenta went with us. We'd heard of traditions in which the placenta is ritually planted to root and protect the child, and of a Chinese tradition of drying and eating the placenta, we thought we might want to bury it. I put it in the guesthouse freezer, wrapped in thick blue plastic and marked, perhaps redundantly, "Placenta, do not eat." We would bury it in the summer, when the ground was soft again, laughing and holding our noses under the oak tree where we were married.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Josh Kampson. He's professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. We're talking about his new book, Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. You can find him at Joshua Gamson, JAMSON.com. Let's go on to Rachel.
Rachel.
I'll say it right. She was deeply affected by 9/11. That's one of the things I remembered that, you know, that sort of struck me, that she was in New York. She was in New York, and she was deeply affected by it. It says, what am I doing with my life? Like, it might have affected so many thousands and millions of people. What am I doing? You know, if life is this fragile, if everything can happen, what am I doing? And so she began to pursue finding a child, wanting a child. And she ended up doing this, adopting her son in Ethiopia.
Right.
It was a difficult and challenging journey for her. I think that's why you use the word journey. Can you tell me a little bit more about that before we? I want you to read that part we talked about, and I just want you to talk a little bit about what that was like for you writing it and knowing about that story, how it affected you.
Well, I've known Rachel, which is not her real name, but I've known Rachel since we were kids at summer camp together, socialist Zionist summer camp. So I've known her forever, basically, and. At the time that 9/11 hit, she was, you know, sort of very serious about her work and had made a plan. She's a planner. She'd made a plan about, you know, she would have a child, you know, after X amount of time. A lot of people do this. A lot of women do this in particular. If they have not met a partner with whom they're going to have a child or raise a child, she'd do it on her own. And 9/11, I think, really made that certain for her. And so she started to pursue this. It's you know, you can read it. It's a long story. But eventually she wound up in Ethiopia with to pick up a child who we called Yisak in the book. And she, for me, it was very hard to imagine all of the distance in so many ways that she had to travel to get to that family. The literal physical distance, the geographical distance, but the cultural distance, the sort of difference in worlds. You know, she's on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and he's in an orphanage from a small town in Ethiopia that's been hard hit at that time by AIDS. You know, it's such a distance to travel and to be able to connect and identify and feel that person as your child, which she felt. Very quickly.
So it's rather mystical.
Yes, mystical and practical at the same time. I have this thing I remember writing about where she started the adoption process, and it was so practical. She seemed really relieved that she could just fill out a piece of paper and another piece of paper and another piece of paper, and eventually that would lead her to this child. So it's both really mundane and really spiritual at the same time.
She goes to get him, Isaac,
right.
And visits the birth family.
Right.
And you're going to read a piece from your book, Josh Gamson's here with me on Out in the Bay, Modern Families, about that meeting.
So she goes to the small town where the grandmother of Isaac lives, and she had given him up to the orphanage because she had other kids around the same age, other grandchildren that she was taking care of, and she just could not do it all, and she met a social worker who had helped her with that decision-making and so on. But of course, Rachel was very nervous going to meet the family, and they're sitting around in the village that's taking, you know, 20 minutes to walk in from the parking area, you know, dusty on these hard benches. And she has an interpreter there, and Rachel asks her, "What do you wish for Yisak?" "I want him to get an education," Yisak's grandmother answered. "I want him to be a good person. I want him to be a kind person, a person who helps others." Rachel began crying, and soon everyone else in the circle was too. Nobody said exactly what they were crying about. I can only imagine the waves of tears. A wave for the loss of a son and daughter-in-law, a wave for the education their son will have, and another for what his cousins will not have, a wave for the hunger of a baby and for bread mashed in water, a wave for the leaky roof and one for the love underneath it, a wave for the joy that cannot be disconnected from grief, a wave for lives you might have lived and another for the stories that cannot be told, a wave for the world that is so unjust and another for the unimaginable connections between strangers, a wave for being a mother alone and another for being surrounded by family, waves for gratitude, anger, beauty, resentment, relief, and hope, a wave for the picture of the little boy with the soft tuft of hair.
It's just so lyrical and moving, the writing, and I really appreciate that about you. And it's our second interview since we talked 10 years ago with the fabulous Sylvester book. And it's the same feeling I have when I listen to you read your writing and when I read your writing, that you're touching into the heart. You know, I think I used the word courage earlier, and I think I probably should have used the word heart. There's a lot of heart in what you've done in writing the book and living your life, in choosing to have children the way and the paths that you've gone, as well as those people, other people in the book. So I just appreciate it a lot, and I don't think we understand without this book more the details of the human lives and what they go through, the desire, not courage but heart and determination.
One of the hard, yes, and one of the hard parts is that there are other people in these stories that are, you just can't get their story. You know, that's as much as I could get about Yitzhak's grandmother. I couldn't go there, and that's right. as much as Rachel could get. So there
so
are these other people.
You had to find
people.
A way to write about it by thinking, by putting yourself in it and opening your heart to it and writing from that place.
And writing about that, writing about what that is like to, mm-hmm. to not be able to know more about the origins mm-hmm. of your family. Mm-hmm. And the other people that are part of that extended kinship.
So there's lots of pain in these stories. You know, unlike maybe, you know, the old model of a man and a woman having a baby and being all happy and baby showers and weddings and all that exciting thing that, you know, the heterosexual world tortures each other with. I mean, does with each other. I'm just kidding.
Are you?
I'm not. You know, I've been talking to lots of my friends lately who are un-gay, as I like to call them, and they're just tortured. These young reporter women, you know, I coach people in public radio, and young reporters who are just tortured by, you know, this, when are you going to have kids? Do you have kids? You need me? They're like, just torture each other. What do you, everyone lighten up. 50% of these marriages end in divorce. What is your problem? Why are you all in such a big hurry to torture each other to fit a role that isn't authentic?
All right,
I'm done.
Honey, we all torture each other.
Oh, now the gays are like, did you guys get married?
Right, exactly.
No, I just call her my wife because she's annoying. All right, I'm done. Let's do one more. You know, this story about your second child, Maddie, mm-hmm. with this woman, Gail, your surrogate.
Right.
In Kentucky. We've all heard enough about Kentucky lately, is so interesting because Gail is such an interesting character in the drama, and because Kentucky gave you a lot of crap. They didn't really want to conform to this gay guys from California trying to have a baby in our state.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. The whole thing was kind of amazing because with the first child, with Reba, it was friends, and it was sort of, you know, contracted, but it was with friends. And then when it came time to have a second child, we decided we would do it directly through an agency. We weren't going to repeat that luck again. And we found Gail through just through a surrogacy agency.
Right.
And she's in Kentucky, and she's willing to do it. And she talked to us on the phone and liked us. And we brought her out to Oakland, and we liked each other. But
is
it was sort of at
mother?
That level.
She's a single mother.
And
At that time,
she had
a baby,
basically, and a teenager and a 10-year-old and a baby at that time. Anyway, so she was an interesting person, and yes, she was at the agency. She signed on with the agency because they pay. That's
right.
All I knew. And there's something so uncomfortable
about
that.
We all think this. They need the money.
Yeah. And that's part of it. There's no doubt that's part of it.
Well, it's got to be. Why else would you do it except there are other reasons she did? We'll get to that.
Then, P.S., she was in Kentucky. And we're like, okay, well,
which is
I guess
really
we're going
nice,
to Kentucky.
There's a lot of really nice people in Kentucky.
There are.
I've been working there the
there
last
are.
Few
I
years.
I learned a lot.
In Murray, Kentucky, a tiny little place that takes forever to get to. The people are really nice, so.
Yeah, the laws weren't so
no, the laws are not
but,
good.
You know.
So let's read a little bit about Gail and Maddie.
Okay, I'm going to read to you about just me going to Kentucky and how that went down. I was not keen on an extended stay in Kentucky, which I figured would be full of homophobia, guns, and fatty foods, and maybe not so safe for a black man, a Jew, and their black Jewish daughter. And let me take you just immediately from there to the hospital. This is after Maddie was born. Our presence at the Bowling Green Medical Center seemed to send the staff of women into Southern hospitality overdrive. They dispensed diapers, advice, and coffee cake. We chatted about four-year-olds, work, the costs of preschool. A nurse named Christy brought a button for Reba that said, "I'm a big sister." Unfamiliar heads popped in and out, sometimes with some excuse to check on us, sometimes without. Not homophobia, but a kind of homo-curious buzz was swirling around us, turning us into objects of gossip, but also of generosity and attention. Anxieties about discrimination were one thing, but my assumptions about homophobia now seemed glib and snobbish. The problem was getting out of there the next day. One sympathetic young clerk had been instructed by hospital lawyers not to put our names down on the birth forms as parents, but Gail had refused to sign anything that gave her legal or financial responsibility for our baby, insisting that she was not the mother. The clerk tried the form with just a father's name, but the computer spit it back, saying it required a mother. So she sent the forms, along with a copy of the California court order, to the Kentucky Office of Vital Statistics with neither father nor mother listed. Her small act of administrative disobedience was, to me, touching. The hospital, not knowing what else to do, released us and our legally parentless baby.
I want you, before we are out of time, I want you to go to that last part about Gail, because I think it's important for the audience to understand a little bit more who this person is. It's such a beautifully written piece, and she's a totally lovable character.
She is. She's a great woman. So when I was going back to get stories for the book, I went and saw her, and we had coffee over Starbucks, and this is what she said. "I really didn't have a desire to go to college. The main thing was I wanted to be a mom. That's all I ever wanted to be. You always hear how you're put on earth to do something, and I kind of thought maybe that would be something great to contribute to this world, is to help someone else. If someone asks what's the greatest things I ever did, of course, have my own kids and to help two couples have a baby." She had since carried for another baby, for another couple. "That's the best things in the world I've ever done." I was suspicious of the relief it brought me to hear that. I believed her, though. I asked her how she thought of her relationship to Maddie, who was 4 years old by then, but whom Gail had only really just met, and who had taken to calling her Gailey. "I always picture myself being an old woman, and her coming to visit me, like me having an 80th birthday party and her being there," Gail said. "And she'll be like, 'This is the one that carried me.' That doesn't even seem far-fetched." That's Gail.
Josh Gamson's been my guest here on Out in the Bay, talking about his extraordinary book, that's right, Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. Thank you so much for writing this book and sharing these stories with us. Without you, we don't know them.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Wow, so great to have you on this radio program. Once again, you can find Josh at Joshua Gamson, GAMSON.com. He's a professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. My best to you and your family.
Thanks.
This program airs Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific and streams at that time at KALW.org. And then it's archived for podcasts at outinthebay.org. You can check out our website, 10 years of award-winning radio. We're the gay Terry Gross, dang it. And make a tax-deductible donation, for heaven's sakes. Thanks to Matt Martin and KALW for their support over the years. Our engineer is Kevin Vance. Eric Jansen and I produce and host this program. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Follow me on Twitter at Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me. Thank you.